Hi, welcome to this Physicians Weekly's podcast. My name is Dr. Rachel Giles. I'm your host for this podcast, and today we've got some great interviews as usual.
This is Physicians Weekly.
Today's episode is brought to you by Microsoft and Nuance. DAX Copilot is an AI-powered solution helping physicians become more efficient. With clinical documentation that writes itself, you can streamline your workflows and get time back in your day to focus on what matters most. Visit nuance.com/physiciansweekly to learn more. That's nuance.com/physiciansweekly. Welcome to this week's podcast. We have something really special in this episode. It's a great discussion between our regular contributor, Dr. Alex McDonald, who's at Southern California Kaiser Permanente, and he's also the president-elect of the California Academy of Family Physicians. And he talks with Dr. Kim Yu, who's the medical director at Aledade and president of the Orange County chapter of the California Academy of Family Physicians. They're both strong proponents of value-based care, and they talk about what the new mandates concerning value-based care are and what that actually might mean to your practice. And Dr. Yu leaves us with some wise words about how she anticipates this panning out.
I really anticipate that we're going to see improved and increased adoption of value-based payments and alternative payment models in every single payer space, whether it be for a Medicare, Medicaid, or commercial patients.
Enjoy listening.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Physicians Weekly podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Alex McDonald. I'm excited to have you all here today, and thanks for joining. I am welcoming one of my good friends today, Dr. Kim Yu, and we are here to talk about what in some circles has become sort of a dirty phrase, value-based care. We'll start there, and we're going to answer all your questions and more regarding what this is and what it means. But first, I'm going to have my guest introduce herself because she's amazing. So, Dr. Yu, thank you so much for joining us. Tell us who you are and what you do.
Thank you so much, Dr. McDonald. And my name is Dr. Kim Yu. I am a family physician and live in Southern California. I am the Prime National Strategy Consultant for the American Board of Family Medicine. And I also work as Director for Healthcare Strategy for KCS, which is a multi-site FQHC in Orange County, serving the Asian community and marginalized populations such as the homeless and patients with substance use disorder. Really excited to be talking to you today about value-based care, and thank you, Alex, for inviting me to share some thoughts about it and with Physicians Weekly podcast.
Awesome. Well, and you wear multiple other hats also. You are perhaps the busiest person that I know, and that's saying something because I know some busy people. And tell us a little bit about some of your prior roles, because I think you come at this from a very unique perspective.
Yeah, so I previously worked as the regional medical director for California and Michigan for Aledade, which is a value-based care company, and then became their national director for clinical and community partnerships, really trying to tell the story of value-based care and really helping physicians and practices and clinics understand what it's about and why it's important. So very important for everyone to understand what is happening with it. And as you say, it has become a little bit of that word, you know, right. Value-based care, right? You know, and people hear it, and then there's a sort of like, it's almost like not as bad as prior auth, but, you know, you say the words value-based care, and then sometimes you'll hear a sort of, what is this? And what are people really saying about it? So I want to be able to clear up some of that and really help people understand what that concept is really all about.
Great. Well, let's just jump right in. Why don't you tell us, what is value-based care?
Value-based care is the concept that physicians should be reimbursed based on patient outcomes instead of just the volume of services provided. And so the goal really is to help individuals maintain the highest possible level of wellness rather than waiting to provide care when patients get sick, which is often more complex and expensive. So in value-based care arrangement practices, clinics, community health centers, hospitals, contract with payers such as Medicare, Medicaid, and other commercial insurance companies to care for a defined set of attributed patients. I like to talk of it more as value-based payment. I think that's more accurate than saying value-based care, because people sometimes misunderstand value-based care and think that, are you trying to say that you're going to just cut costs? No, it's not about just cutting costs. It really is, you know, especially because the U.S. health system is the most costly in the world. It's really important for patients to have care, the right care at the right time, at the right place, and really meet the objectives of the quintuple aim, right? Which everyone wants, you know, improved health outcomes, decreased costs, better patient and clinician experience, whilst addressing and improving health equity. So I think that value-based payment is a much more accurate term. And the care that you provide is the care that we all as physicians want to be able to provide our patients.
Thank you so much for just sort of laying that out there. I think that's really helpful to kind of level set to make sure we're all on the same page when we're talking about value-based care, payment, whatever you want to call it. But really, it's ultimately about kind of doing what's best for the patient, right? You know, we, as you mentioned, the U.S. has the most expensive healthcare in the world and some of the worst health outcomes. So clearly, the fee-for-service model is not working. And I think the fear of the unknown, especially when it comes to somebody's finances and keeping their practice open and running, it's obviously provokes a lot of anxiety. And sort of the devil you know is sometimes better than the devil you don't know. And so I think that is where a lot of this trepidation comes from. Would you agree? Like, do you have any other thoughts there?
Yeah, definitely. I think that there are many who have gone through all the different things that we've been through, from HMOs to capitation to PCMH to all of this thing. And they're just like, well, isn't this just a repackaging of the same thing? And it really isn't. It really is a different type of payment model that really can help provide resources for your practices to be able to do the work that we want to be able to do. And so I really see it as transformative in many ways. I remember talking to a family doc in Maryland, and in Maryland, they have this amazing program called the MDPCP Heart Program, where they get a payment to the practice to help them care for patients who have multiple different diagnoses. You know, you're diabetic, depressed, morbidly obese, hypertensive with cholesterol and thyroid issues and all of that, right? And if you have a patient that lives in certain zip codes with high social needs and where there's high social determinants of health in that area, and the Maryland Heart Payment will actually pay a payment to the practice. And those have provided such resources for those physicians to be able to get community health workers, to get transportation for those patients, to get resources above and beyond what they would normally be able to provide for those patients to get care and improve care. And they've seen that that model works. And so that's been a big driver in the changes that are coming along with CMS, that they've provided multiple different models now to be able to help physicians and their practices get the resources they need to be able to care for patients.
I think one thing that I've heard from some of my fellow physicians is there is so much that impacts people's health, social determinants of health. There's, you know, 90% of a person's health is related to where they live, work, play, you know, raise a family, et cetera, et cetera. And really only 10 to 15% is due to actual health care access and seeing physicians and hospitals. And so this onus is being put on the healthcare system and put on doctors to really take care of patients when so much of this is really beyond our control. And so I think that's the trepidation a lot of physicians have is like, look, you're going to pay me or not pay me for 90% of things that I can't control. But I really think that this system, in terms of just risk stratifying and sort of giving a lump payment for, especially for higher social need or for higher resource intensive patients, to really, again, do the work and help build the systems to prevent the illness in the first place, right? Because ultimately, exactly, that's the goal.
Yeah, exactly. And being able to do population health, really, right, being able to do good population health, which for many of us, you know, we're just taught very individually, you know, take care of the person that's right in front of you and not to really think of the population. But that's part of parcel why I'm so excited to work for ABFM and the board, you know, have developed such amazing tools to be able to look at population health. They have something called the FATE engine, which is a population health assessment tool engine. And it's just assessment engine. And it's really amazing to see how you can put information in there and get back data that helps you at point of care know for each patient where they live, what the census tract data is for that patient. So you know ahead of time, almost even, you can see where the patient's social needs may be, mm-hmm. you know, if they're in an area of high deprivation, and to give a community vital sign, not just a patient vital signs that we take the blood pressure, pulse, and whatever, but a community vital sign to be able to help you and your practice determine what resources they need. And then to also layer on top of that information from Find Help. It was Aunt Bertha before, and now it's mm-hmm. Find Help, where you can press a button and know exactly for that patient from the tool what resources are available. So it's almost like having a mini social worker or community health worker helping you in your practice, but through the engine and through the tools available to you. So I'm super excited about how we can make population health really a viable thing that we can get practices to do, and for physicians and their staff to really understand for their patients in an easier way than previously before. So making data usable mm-hmm. and actionable at point of care is super important in this move to value-based care.
I think that's the key, is we are sometimes inundated with data, but it's not in a useful context or a meaningful context that we can actually do anything with. It's great to see these pretty graphs and pie charts and maps, but like, how does that actually help me take care of the patient sitting in front of me right now as an individual physician? And I think that's some of the frustration with many physicians in this day and age. Do you think that we have a gap between medical education and residency and actual practice at this point when it comes to community health and population health?
Absolutely. There's a major gap because we often aren't taught. I know that I wasn't taught.
Right.
We had it was a fantastic residency program, 1 month, though, of population health. And none of it really on what do you really do when you're actually in a practice and actually having to address population health. And so we do need to build systems in place for our residencies. And that's something that we're working on at the board, to really identify residency programs that want to really help the residents learn population health, dig in. We've got medical schools that are using our tools to also teach the medical students about population health and how to really access these resources to find out more information from census tract data and other public use files that are available to really help drive information. And how do you really adequately get the information from your EHR? Do you know which fields to put the information so that when the EHR at the end of the year pulls everything out, they're pulling the right data
right.
at the right place mm-hmm. to say, yes, this patient had their colonoscopy, and oh, you didn't put the advanced care plan in the right place, you know, and suddenly everything falls to pieces, right? So ensuring that you've got a dashboard, right? Imagine if you had a dashboard that could tell you all your care gaps. Those things are available. You know, there are registries, there are population health tools and other tools available that you can get that. And, you know, you being at Kaiser, you've seen some of those, right? And it's really good that there are systems in place, both in large systems and in small independent practices, where they're able to get access to the data that they need. That's really kind of exciting to me.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, I was not trained at all. I think, again, being a physician here at Southern California Permanente, you know, I have all this, it's a closed system. We have all the patient care gaps. We know when their last PAP was. We know where the social needs are. We have all this data that we can pull together and see kind of what they're due for, to really do that preventative work to prevent illness. Ultimately, I don't know any physician who went into medicine to not prevent illness or to ease suffering, right? And so many of us, I think, get caught in this dysfunctional system where we're just sort of on the hamster wheel and we're just, you know, plugging holes in the dam, so to speak, as opposed to really kind of fixing the whole dam, to take the analogy a bit farther. So this is such a great level set to kind of understand the why behind all of this. What do you say to kind of the naysayers, to maybe a lot of those like small and solo practices who are literally just struggling to kind of keep their doors open and get by? What do you say to them when they're like, look, I don't have time for this. Like, I can't do this. It's not realistic. Like, what do you say to them, and where can they go to learn more and to really kind of implement that change that I think we ultimately need in this healthcare system?
You know, I think it's really important to think of, do you want to have more margin for more mission? We all want to be able to do more and to be able to provide our patients more, better care. And is there a way that we can do it? And there is. And so, you know, you can choose to not adopt right? You could say, okay, you're one of the people that's not going to have the latest iPhone or the Apple Watch or whatever. Mm-hmm. You're going to wait and see. And or you can choose to be an early adopter, or at least right at this point, you know, value-based care isn't just coming. It's already here. Mm-hmm. And it's going to stay. We know that it's a CMS imperative that they've actually mandated and want the vast majority of the Medicare fee-for-service patients to be in a care relationship with accountability for quality and total cost of care by 2030.
Right. That's not far away.
2030. That is 6 years away. Mm-hmm. 6 years away. And so to get every single Medicare patient, and not only every single Medicare patient, but the vast majority of Medicaid beneficiaries, Medicaid patients too, to be in those type of relationships, we're talking millions and millions of patients. Mm-hmm. So will you be in that type of relationship with your patient, or are you going to be left behind?
Right.
Are you going to be able to dive in, get the resources you need to be able to make the transformation? Because it is work. It's not an insignificant amount of work, but it's probably work that some of it you're already doing. Mm-hmm. It's just doing it smarter and getting the data for it. I tell people it's a little bit like WD-40. You know, we want WD-40 to make things less squeaky,
right,
make things run smoothly, right? Well, we need WDR. Okay. And so that's my little acronym for making, you know, value-based care a little bit easier and less burden to relieve the burden, right? We need to have workforce, we need to have data, and we need to have resources.
Interesting.
And so getting, you know, making sure that you have that champion, making sure you have your team and you educate everyone on the why, and then making sure you have your data, I think it's critical to be able to put your data to work. And as you say, to have point of care information, maybe you want to put it in a clinical registry, and then building those resources, whether it be population health tools or whether it be getting finances to your practice, mm-hmm, to be able to do the transformation, making sure you've got a certified EHR or the community health workers or social workers or the care managers, whoever it is that you need for your team to be able to do the work. That's truly going to transform the way you practice.
I love that. WDR. And sometimes when you're like spraying the WD-40 on the hinges, you sometimes make a mess and you have to clean it up afterwards. And so sometimes you don't get in just the right spot of the hinge to begin with. Anyway, I can go farther with the analogy, but I love that. And to your point also, I mean, I say this time and time again, medicine is a team sport, and it's becoming an increasingly team sport. And the way those teams are designed and built today is going to be very different than tomorrow, or, you know, 6 years down the road even. And really getting community health workers and getting people out at the front lines, because there aren't enough physicians. We're already facing a physician shortage, particularly in primary care. And if we can get more of these support systems and these teams in place to prevent illness, that's ultimately the goal. You kind of already addressed this a little bit, but I want to ask your question. Like, so in terms of like the policy versus the actual practice, like, is the horse out of the barn at this point when it comes to value-based care with the policy? Or do you think that there's going to be any kind of policy shifts and we're going to kind of maintain the status quo for certain aspects of healthcare within the industry? Or is this mostly primary care? Or are we now kind of so far down the road, there's no going back?
I don't think we're going back. I think that CMS and others have seen the success from programs like the Medicare Shared Savings Program and mm-hmm. others. Mm-hmm. They're developing it, though. CMMI has really looked at different models of care, and, you know, direct contracting became ACO REACH, and now we have the Make Care Primary program in 8 states that is being piloted for 10 years, and also the AHEAD program, which is actually going to be in 50 states, right?
Oh, wow.
And so what's really interesting is that the model is changing. And so their CMS is asking states and state agencies and health agencies to get involved as well. And so we're seeing this sort of like global you know, way of looking at value-based care rather than just at a very individual level, but like globally, how do we as physicians in primary care work with our subspecialty care physicians, and how do we ensure that transitions of care are really well done, that ED visit follow-up happens, you know, all of these things that can really impact care. And I really anticipate that we're going to see improved and increased adoption of value-based payments and alternative payment models in every single payer space, whether it be for a Medicare, Medicaid, or commercial patients, and that the ideas behind it, the population health ideals that we all want to be able to provide better health at lower cost and all of those type of things, really will become pivotal in everyday vernacular. Like, we're all going to have to become really facile in it and to understand it deeply. So it's exciting. I think there are some risks, right? There are also some risks with value-based care. And, you know, I sometimes sit there thinking, is it possible that we build this system and that there will be some issues, right? Well, what are the issues, you know? And some may say, well, I don't have time, I don't have money, you know, all of those type of things, which are very valid in some ways. But my concern really stems more about the fact that I don't want any patient left behind.
Right.
I don't think that cherry picking, as they call it, is what any physician's practice or hospital or system or payer should be doing. We shouldn't be determining, I'm going to take care of the, you know, most well patients so that my numbers look great, right? And that my costs are lower than if I take care of a high need, marginalized population with high social drivers, right? So I think it's very important we address that and really ensure that there are policies and procedures in place to protect patients from cherry picking from occurring. The second thing that I see as a threat, actually, to independent primary care and also just to ensuring that patients get the care they need when they need it, I've observed, and I'm not going to call any names out, but I've observed that there are certain large systems or large pharmacy chains that are getting into the business of value-based care. And they are buying value-based care organizations or making partnerships with them and then purchasing independent primary care practices, which on the one hand relieves the burden from the practice of having to pay bills, et cetera, but at the same time decreases their autonomy. And decreases the ability for them to have control of that patient-physician relationship. And when you've built a practice over years, I was in solo private practice for over 10 years, that is paramount. That trust you build with the patient is paramount. And I've seen it where patients are being funneled to pharmacy clinics. And then, lo and behold, they're being told your practice is being closed down. And a practice where a physician may have worked 10, 20, 30 years is suddenly gone in a community. And that could have been in a rural community or in an urban setting where there are no other primary care physicians there. So it's vital we ensure that we protect those smaller independent primary care practices from larger systems that are closing them down. Because at the end of the day, it decreases the care that our patients get.
Yeah, those community-based practices are just so critical in that relationship that you have between the patient and the physician. I have patients who sometimes see another one of my colleagues or they're seeing somewhere else and they will then send me an email being like, hey, I got prescribed this new medicine. Should I take it? Right? Because I'm their primary care doctor and they know me and they trust me and we've built that relationship over years and years. I feel that I do worry a bit about sort of the corporatization of medicine and how, you know, patients are just sort of widgets in a factory turning out, you know, widgets, whatever. And I do worry about that as well. You know, there are certainly some risks, and I think it's important that we sort of go into this with eyes wide open. But at the same time, your story of telling me about kind of making sure these patients don't fall through the cracks, I had a patient in the hospital that I rounded on this morning, actually, who you know, heart failure, substance use disorder, obstructive sleep apnea, pulmonary hypertension, and he wasn't taking his medicines because he couldn't afford his medicines. And so had we been able to have a community health worker get out to him, figured out how we can have some kind of medical financial assistance for this patient so that they can take their medicines, so they can get the substance use disorder, they would not end up in the hospital, right? And
exactly.
Ultimately, that would have been so much cheaper than, you know, a 3-day stay in the hospital, even though our system is set up to just put them in the hospital. To your point about building systems that are really patient-centered, and there was a really interesting article that I read, and it was talking about value-based care, but basically it said that the name is wrong. It's not value-based care. It's patient-centered care.
Exactly.
Ultimately, because I don't know anyone that wants to go to the hospital. I don't know anyone that wants surgery. And if we can really wrap these services around the patient early, then we can prevent all the problems. And obviously, you know, with like anything, there are some risks, there are some downsides, but being methodical, being transparent about how the system is built and set up so that we can ultimately do what's best for the patients and not just kind of feed into the special interests who are taking over the healthcare industry. But I will not pontificate about that. I could go on and on.
I know. I think a lot about, you know, this patient-centered idea, because we do actually have, and maybe I wonder whether you knew about this, Alex, but there is a patient-centered primary care measure. Did you know that?
I didn't know
there that. There is, and it's actually developed by the ABFM, and it's part of what we call our patient-reported outcomes module in the PRIME registry. And you can access that if you're a diplomate and if you're doing primary care, you can actually access the PRIME registry to be able to have those measures where you can look at patient trust. So the patients actually fill these surveys that talk about how much do I trust my doctor, right? But also, you know, this patient-centered primary care measure actually measures the relationship between the patient and their physician, clinician, staff person, right? And there's multiple questions that are asked. And it, for me, it's really quite fascinating. I mean, from just like a sort of high level look, but even just thinking, if this was my measure, right, how am I doing? And how do I compare to my peers? And what can I do to ensure it's better? It's almost like a net promoter score, but in a much nicer way, right? To be able to have that. And that is solely a measure from the ABFM, because they really wanted to ensure that we created measures that matter and prioritize resources and attract resources to primary care to support comprehensive relationships with patients. He said relationship a lot.
No, and I don't know any physician that's not maybe a little type A and a little competitive, and it's always nice to kind of see how you compare to your peers, not in a negative way, but just in a friendly, just informational way, right? Like, hey, this is kind of the average, and you're below average, you're above average, right? And I think that's really meaningful data for someone. I'll speak for myself, someone like myself who is very evidence-based and data-driven. That's great to know. All right, this is a wonderful conversation. We could probably go on and on and on, and maybe we'll have a whole series about this as this unfolds over the next couple of years. But I do want to kind of keep this high yield and wrap up. So tell us, where can physicians learn more about this? There's obviously a lot happening and a lot coming down the pike. So where can physicians learn more information about value-based care and just empower themselves with knowledge?
You can get lots of resources actually through the American Medical Association. They have a whole section on value-based care. The American Academy of Family Physicians has some really wonderful articles, even some short videos and hack videos that talk about value-based care as well. And if you want to Google me, you can even find me on a California Academy of Family Physicians website. I have a short article on value-based care as well as some videos on YouTube. Obviously, your payers and your ACOs, your accountable care organizations, CMS, they all have resources as well about the newer models that are out and available and that may be coming to your state very shortly, like the Medicare Primary or the AHEAD model. So I do recommend highly that you really read those resources very carefully and also perhaps go to NACOS, which is the National Association of ACOs. They have a conference in April. And so if you'll be there, let me know because I'll be there too.
Last question, and perhaps the most important question, what makes you most proud to be a physician?
Oh, that is such a great question. When I think of my ikigai, my reason for being, it's a Japanese term that means reason for being. What makes me most proud is really thinking about how do we change things so that patients have another day?
Mm-hmm.
We've been through so much the past few years with COVID, with everything, with all the changes, right, in healthcare. And, you know, we hear about burnout rates are the highest ever. And I sit there and think, did what I do on a daily basis, whether it's the work I'm doing right now, looking at Prime Registry or the work I'm doing at the FQHC, is it making a difference for my patients and for my fellow family physicians and physicians in the House of Medicine? Like, yeah. I think that's what makes a difference and lets me sleep at night.
Wonderful. Wonderful. That's such a great note to end on. Dr. Yu, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you so much for sharing your expertise. This is clearly an ongoing issue. We'll probably have to have you back in the coming years as this continues to unfold. And I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
That's all the time we have for today's podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe and stay healthy.
Stay tuned for our next episode as we are joined by top thought leaders to discuss the latest groundbreaking research presented at this month's top annual medical meeting. Physicians Weekly is produced in collaboration with Medicom Medical Publishers and Physicians Weekly.